try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven's fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, or even share with your friends. And also products out of the Time for Awakening shop. You can shop for different products in our partnership with the B.B. Toomey language classes, political science classes, history classes, from various professors on the continent and in the diaspora. So take a look at it. That's timeforanawakening.com and go to the shop page. And make that money a favor and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight we were scheduled to have a special guest. In fact, I had a little mix-up with both of our guests. One of our guests will be on with us this evening from the Black Policy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Kevin Coakley will be with us. And we'll get started with the program right after the break. You can stay with us and be part of the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellie.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm enjoying the weather here. The weekend was fine. We had a family reunion here in Philadelphia. You know, small. I'm gonna call it a small gathering, but you know, a gathering of serious groups. So that was interesting to get to talk to. I always like mess with the. I interact with the. Young members of the family, which is always a learning experience with me, and it was all good, and you know, then prepared to engage in, and I was looking forward to getting, you know, some more information on what's going on that we're getting to talk with. You know, when I seen the article from Dr. Coakley, I was excited to, you know, that we should interview, you know, just have him on and expand on his view he did about using Juneteenth as a means of interconnecting with the continent. So I'm looking forward to that discussion.
And, you know, it was a mix up on my part because I had talked with Professor Coakley and had him penciled in for this evening. But when we got the call about Mr. Hanif Muhammad, who was the director of Justice Africa Sudan, wanted to come on and give the listening audience an update on what was going on, I kind of jumped at it without kind of looking back. Things worked out kind of as planned anyway, because the internet is still down in that area, and he thought he could reach out to me with other means, but the other means, the time is limited for him to make an international call. So we're going to reschedule him possibly for next week or maybe the week after to get him on to kind of talk about that situation. It's kind of fluent, it's ongoing, and it's things like that happening in different areas of the continent. So it's going to be interesting because he kind of networks with other organizations. He's a contributor to the African Union and several other organizations and writes for different publications. So he not only has the finger on the pulse of the Sudan, but other areas of the continent where he can kind of speak knowledgeably on. So it'll be good to have him on to talk with our listening audience and see how those things, Richard, kind of relate to here. It's kind of ironic that you're having these rumblings on the continent and rumblings here. It's an awakening happening, Richard. I fully believe that.
I definitely agree.
You have a segment of our people that might not realize it. Some of our people are caught up with the television and popular media, and they don't look behind the scenes. I think it's important for our people to really study world events, study our history, study the history of the European that colonized those areas and kidnapped our ancestors and brought us here to understand what's really going on. I think the article that was published by our guest, Dr. Kevin Coakley, and it was in several publications, San Antonio Paper and different publications around. He talked about Juneteenth. He took that opportunity to talk about the observance of Juneteenth and how our people should use that opportunity to reconnect with the continent. And let's bring our guests on, Professor Dr. Kevin Coakley. Dr. Coakley, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm glad to have you with us, sir.
glad to be here.
I just want to apologize for that little mix-up. I kind of jumped at that opportunity when we could get an update on something that was going on currently. And to be honest, I kind of, with all these papers and all over the desk, I kind of lost that we were supposed to do something today. But it's no problem because, in fact, I would have had you on either way. I would have just brought you on at a little bit of later time because his time would have been a little limited with us being an international call. But things worked out like they were supposed to work out, and I'm glad to have you with us this evening. Dr. Coakley, your article, it was brought to my attention through my co-host, Brother Richard. We posted it on the Time for an Awakening page and got some response from it, from the people that, kind of look at the different articles that we put on Time for an Awakening. And it was entitled, well, it had different titles if you look at it in different mm-hmm. publications. The one I saw it in, it had Juneteenth should be a time for African Americans to connect with Africa and Africans in the Americas. Talk about the genesis of that article, Dr. Coakley, and yourself being the Black Policy Institute director at the University of Texas at Austin. Talk about it from your perspective of lecturing, talking about history of Africans in America and on the continent. And even if you want to mix in some of the Black Policy Institute protocols that you might use, talk about it from the perspective of how you frame this article.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, for having me on the program. The genesis of this article really would date back 20 plus years. So I am a professor of African and African diaspora studies and educational psychology at the University of Texas at Austin. I also, as you noted, direct what we sort of refer to as the Black Policy Institute. Its formal name is the Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis. And it's situated within Black Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. And for 20 plus years, I've taught a class called Psychology of the African American Experience. It's a very African-centered, Afrocentric approach towards understanding the psychological experience of people of African descent. And just to kind of give you a little bit of background about who I am, you know, my Jegna, my intellectual mentor, would be someone by the name of Baba Asa Hilliard. Mm-hmm. And I come from that school of thought with Baba Asa Hilliard, Wade Nobles, Naeem Akbar, Marimba Aini, those sort of folks. And so I cut my intellectual teeth on those readings and the readings of people like Chikonta Diop. I heard you play a clip from John Henry Clark earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little bit about sort of who I am intellectually. And I've taught this class, Psychology of the African-American Experience, for a number of years. And the genesis of this article really came from the fact that I was in Ghana, and I was in Ghana for about 10 days as part of this research experience. I am one of three faculty mentors who's mentoring or serving as a research advisor for undergraduate students who are doing research in Accra right now. They are doing interviews asking students about their understanding of colorism and the use of skin bleaching products, which we know has been banned in Ghana, but unfortunately some of our brothers and sisters still feel the need to use them.
Okay.
And so while I was there, you know, I realized that my time there was going to overlap with this commemoration of Juneteenth. And I decided that I needed to write this article and to time it so that I could sort of tie my experience being in Ghana with this Juneteenth commemoration. And so that's sort of where it came from. And, you know, for me, I do a lot of public writing, sort of writing op-eds for different media outlets. And what I wanted to do was to write a piece that connected our celebration of Juneteenth with our brothers and sisters on the continent. And in writing it, it just sort of, the spirit moved me, because I sort of came up with this idea or this sort of this approach where I would point out the irony of how we celebrate and commemorate Juneteenth, and yet so many of us don't want to really embrace our African ancestry, our African heritage, and we try to distance ourselves from the continent and from our brothers and sisters, you know, who are African. And so that's sort of where the idea came from.
Richard, because you brought this article to my attention, I want you to go ahead.
You know, Dr. Coakley, Brother Coakley, I'm glad to hear the elders that you helped develop the framework and the research perspective that you're coming from, because we definitely need that. And I was looking at the title of your book, The Myth of Black Anti-Intellectualism, True Psychology of African American Students. And yeah, just what you said in relationship to Juneteenth, and how, you know, that juxtaposition that's going on here, especially in our mental space. And I would like you to kind of continue to explore that as we create the celebration, say, that is honoring the removal out of slavery, enslavement, but at the same time, not necessarily seeing ourselves as global African people because of us being, especially us in the diaspora, and in America specifically. So you're kind of raising the point of, or at least I wanted to have you explore, could Juneteenth be a mental healing process as far as it relates to our African identity, as using it as a vehicle for that? I don't know if that makes sense, but in thinking about what your, you know, the article, how it impacted me, that's what I wanted to ask, and especially your background.
Well, it absolutely could. I think what happens with the celebration, you know, and again, I'm here in Texas, and we know that, you know, Juneteenth obviously holds a very special place for African Americans in the state of Texas. And what I see happening is that there's the celebration, but that there's not a more critical conversation about, you know, what is it really that we're celebrating? And I think sort of what happens is,
great,
you know, African Americans are like, well, you know, we're celebrating the fact that, you know, the abolition of the last remaining enslaved Africans in Texas, and, you know, and they found out a couple years, you know, later, but, you know, they found out, and then, you know, and they were freed. Well, yeah, that's true, but let's sort of go a little bit deeper. So they were enslaved Africans, right? And so you know, we want to lay claim to that. We want to celebrate that. But let's not just sort of celebrate it as sort of this exercise of a holiday. Let's talk psychologically about what that really means. Now, so as an African-centered psychologist, what that means to me is that we have to first and foremost reclaim our Africanity, our Africanism, and we have to sort of be unabashedly African. Now, that's the part that I don't think happens with the celebration of Juneteenth. It's just simply we became free, but who were we? And do you recognize that as a part of your sort of collective identity? And that's the conversation that I think we need to have and that we really haven't had.
Yeah, and I agree wholeheartedly. and this goes to the point, you know, of, as the article kind of, you know, laying our connection with the continent itself, because there's a lot of, in this discussion, and I might be throwing in a couple of things in order to make the point, but in this discussion around reparations, there is a nativism that is kind of holding to this being disconnected to African identity, which would make us see ourselves different than the Africans on the continent, which really don't make any sense because, as a, you know, it don't make any sense. So, and that deeper that you see, and dealing with the psychology of identity, how do you see us? And I'm asking this for this reason, because in Pennsylvania, they've put it as a law, the governor just signed it in law, that Juneteenth will be celebrated. So now the state involved in this here, quote unquote, supporting this activity. But if it isn't, as you're saying, really reinforcing our identity, what is it really happening? So what are the things that should be incorporated in the celebration from a psychological or mental perspective, as you see, in relationship to identity?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I think
continue.
That
that's good. We need to hear it.
but I think that what needs to happen is a reinforcement of our identity. So I'll give you an example. So Baba Asa Hilliard, when he was alive, he made this statement that was very sort of simple, but yet very profound. You know, and he essentially said, "To be African or not to be." Right. And when he said that, you know, I remember Baba Wade Nobles in particular, just sort of like he grabbed onto that, you know, that play on who was it, Shakespeare, to be or not to be. Mm-hmm. But you know, instead of saying to be African, you know, we either accept the fact that we are African or we don't really exist. Mm-hmm. And so what I think we have to do, you know, with any sort of celebration of Juneteenth, is to continue to really ingrain in our people's minds and consciousness the fact that we are African people, part of the diaspora. We are connected to a global African family, and that where we ended up was by, you know, was by sort of a historical set of circumstances, but that does not disconnect us from our root, our African root, our African family. And we have to not be afraid to say, I'm African. You know, you'll see that one of the things that I pointed out in the article was how my, you know, my African-American students, you know, too many times will, you know, sort of make jokes about sort of Africans, you know, or at least they will talk about how, as students, they would sort of use that phrase, African booty scratching, and they, you know, think it's very funny and they laugh. And my African students, and I tend to have a lot of Nigerian American students, you know, they'll typically sort of sit very stone faced because, you know, they don't see it as very funny. And so when I challenge my African American students, you know, why do you find that to be funny? What they oftentimes will claim is it's not the African part, it's the word booty scratching. Dr. Coakley, you know, it's just a funny word, it's funny sounding. And I say, well, let's check this out. Okay, so if that's really the case, if that's the truth, how many times have you ever heard the expression Asian booty scratcher? How many times have you ever heard the expression Hispanic or Latino or Latinx booty scratcher? You know, how many times have you heard the word booty scratcher attached to any other sort of, you know, ethnic or racial or cultural group? You don't hear it. You only hear it in reference to Africans. And that's perpetuating this long racist narrative about Africa being an uncivilized place. Mm-hmm. And that's part of, you know, the miseducation that we have gone through, that you don't even think about. Why is it that we use that term in conjunction with Africans, and why do we find it to be funny? Mm-hmm. And so once I sort of dropped that on them, then there's silence, and they have to sort of really sort of process what it is that I'm saying and to accept the fact that, no, it's not the word booty scratcher that they find funny. It's the fact that it's attached to Africa and to Africans, and it perpetuates this racist narrative about Africa being an uncivilized place.
And it raises a question about, you know, what you're saying also in relationship to Juneteenth, the lack of our own self-identity, whether, you know, how do we see ourselves as African, even if we're saying we're Americans, or, I mean, they're celebrating and celebrating a supposedly creating these events around an event that occurred because we were African or property in the American experience. So doesn't it really also reflect some of our own self-hatred when we're kind of unconsciously degrading Africans unknowingly, at the same time being African, you know, at a certain level? And I know, you know, so that's my thought. And isn't that a dual activity going on, that's making our own, reinforcing our own self-denial of identity and historical context when we are doing that?
No, absolutely. When you're making fun of Africans, you're making fun of yourself, and you don't even realize it. It's a negation of oneself.
Dr. Coakley, following that train of conversation that Brother Richard introduced, because I'm looking at the two assessments you made of the students, African-American students that you've taught over the years, and also African students from the continent that you've taught. And you talk about their, and I'm glad you have these critical discussions with them, because we don't have that enough. We should have these critical discussions in our community centers, in our churches, definitely in our homes. It's time for critical discussions to be had in the airwaves. That's why we use this program, to have critical discussions, to have guests on, to have critical discussions, because it's too many, and it's too much of laughing and joking every day. If you turn on I'm quite sure if you turn on the radio in Austin in the morning, you're going to hear Steve Harvey or Tom Joyner laughing and joking with satires, Amos and Andy, when there's critical things going on that need to be discussed. But that's what our airwaves are used for generally. If you turn on to white stations, they have Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, whatever that, I mean, mm-hmm. however we look at them, they're talking about critical discussions that they think relate to white folks. And they're talking about it from a European perspective. But where's the mm-hmm. When we flip the script, we hear laughing and joking constantly. That's why we use this program to have critical discussions with guests, whether they be historians, educators, journalists, it spans the gamut. But let me go back to what I wanted to raise. When you had this critical discussion with the students, a couple of things that you made mention of here, when they refer to African from the continent that are their fellow students, they smell or they think they're better than us. Now, let me go to that second one, because I want to focus in on that. That comments that you hear from the students about they think they're better than us, that's not just the students. You hear that from adults. I have a business, and the majority, over 90% of my people, 90% of my customers are African-American, and you hear it. Now, let me flip the script and go to the comments you said that African students make about students of the diaspora, which is our people here. They don't value education. They don't respect their elders. They have no sense of family. You said the Yoruba people use a word called akata, meaning a wildcat that does not live at home. So when you hear these comments made by both sides, if you have a critical discussion, then it's some truth in both of what they're saying, but it's a wizard behind the screen, so to speak, like that movie, The Wizard of Oz. They didn't know what was going on until they went to the town and pulled the curtain back and seen the puppet master. The one that have created this situation on both sides of the Atlantic is Europeans and the system of white supremacy. So we have to really get to the brass tacks of what is causing these behavior, because they translate into behaviors. These thoughts translate into behaviors. And let me raise something, too, because it's the elephant in the room that really does not like to be discussed by African-Americans. And I'm going to raise it, and I'm not raising it to bash anything. I'm raising it for a critical assessment or discussion. One of the real elephants in the room is religion. I'm talking about one of the reasons I believe, and this is just one of the reasons, that our people look at our brothers and sisters on the continent as far as being backwards, not having good sense, any type of negative stereotype you can attach to them, is that for some reason we believe the European narrative that our people there are idol idolaters or godless. They have no sense of the Almighty, and they need to be saved. They need somebody to save their souls, because at this point they're headed to hell. So when you see our people attaching themselves to the continent, generally it's in some type of missionary, a type of work. My church is going there. We're going to build some wells for people that don't have water. We're going to give them Jesus Christ and things of that nature. And we see what's going on both here and on the continent in relation to religion. How much does religion, just in your assessment of a critical discussion, how much does religion play a part in how our people view both our people here and on the continent?
Well brother, I think that you have, you know, hit on a critical point. Religion plays a tremendous role. And let me share this. Because I, you know, had the opportunity to sort of, you know, be in Accra for, you know, just under 2 weeks, one of the things that became very apparent to me, and I knew this, you know, on one level, but I had to be there to actually sort of really understand it, is that Ghanaians, you know, in particular, since I was in Accra, Ghana, are extremely religious. Ghana is listed as one of the most religious countries in the world.
Okay.
And I suspect that would be said for many of the African countries.
Yes.
And so many of them are Christians. Now, right. You know, we could have a conversation about sort of like, you know, black man and Christianity and whether black people should be Christians. I don't want to sort of get into that other than to say that with the NAND, you had there were a large number of Ghanaians who were extremely religious, Christians. And, you know, you had some who also practiced, you know, more sort of traditional spiritual systems, but they're very religious. And so I don't think that many African-Americans understand that. You know, to your point, I think that there is this sort of idea that, you know, you have Africans who are sort of, you know, they don't know who God is, they don't know who Jesus Christ is, that they sort of are worshiping, you know, idols and or whatever. And they have no idea who, you know, Africans are and really what they believe. And that's why I think a trip to the continent, you know, to a place like, you know, Ghana would be so transformative, because it would shatter, I think, in many cases, you know, the stereotypes that many African-Americans have about Africa.
But the thing that concerns me, and I'm wondering, when you're through the Policy Institute and trying to connect that to Juneteenth, which is a programmatic thing, you know, our self-identity is supposed to serve our cultural, political, and economic ends, right? And this mechanism of Juneteenth and the reason that I took, and you're making the point of connecting with the continent, because if we operated out of our historical, what Juneteenth represents, and our identity, then we'll see from a cultural, political, and economic perspective that it would be to our advantage compared to our disadvantage. But because of this schism, and Elliot, you called, I see the media also as a perpetuator of this here self-derogating self-image of Africans in the diaspora and also of Africans on the continent. But how do you see that from a policy perspective being perpetuated when we're talking about, you know, here, as I mentioned, in Pennsylvania, the governor is signing a bill to support Juneteenth, Pennsylvania, state that was truly a, what's that guy named? The president.
No, Trump.
45.
Mm-hmm.
Trump. State. No. It seems, you know what I mean? It seems like another contradiction in itself, that if we're not aligning ourselves to our identity and our cultural and political and economic potential, which is aligning with the continent, how are we using a mechanism? Is that mechanism of Juneteenth becoming just another vehicle for what Elliot calls the laughing and dancing and singing, compared to something that we're reinforcing and our own identity and healing and using it for a vehicle? How did that, if anything, from a policy perspective, touch you while you were there looking at and trying to connect here?
Well, so from a policy perspective, and you know, for my institute, we cover really five different areas, you know, regarding policy, you know, education, criminal justice, income and poverty, housing, income and poverty, criminal justice, housing, and education, and health and mental health. And I tend to focus a lot on education, because I believe education is ground zero for everything else that we sort of, you know, see in terms of, you know, life outcomes for people of African descent. And from a policy standpoint, what we teach our kids or what is taught to them becomes what ultimately either can liberate them or can sort of psychologically destroy them. So I think about an example where we had in Texas, it must have been about, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, the State Board of Education was trying to really sort of change the way that the enslavement, you know, of African people were taught. And they did not want to use the words, you know, slavery. they wanted to sort of use something along the lines of the triangular sort of trading, they translated triangular trading, or some other sort of euphemism that really sort of took away from the horrors of what we know to be our mob or the enslavement of our people. They didn't want to sort of talk about or have to talk to students just how pernicious that entire sort of experience was for our people. And it's things like that that can, and if you think about it, in Texas, because Texas is either the first or the second largest sort of consumers of textbooks, what we end up having in our textbooks can then sort of influence what is produced in textbooks throughout the country.
Mm-hmm,
and that's why you had so many, people really upset and fighting over not allowing that to happen. Because if it had been allowed to happen, the way that slavery or the enslavement of African people is taught to students would have been changed potentially throughout the entire country, and they would have softened it and sort of made it so that kids, especially our kids, would not have really had a true understanding of the horrific nature of enslavement. So from a policy standpoint, I tend to focus on what policies are in place that sort of control what is put into our textbooks that then are sort of just taught to our kids. So that's where I tend to start.
And how does, with that being said, maybe if you had a chance to review that from the perspective of Juneteenth, how does that play out in the narrative of what Juneteenth is? Because I think that aligns with my concern when, you know, especially as move forward, you know, to this whole thing of identifying 400 years of Africans' experience. It's kind of being celebrated, but it's not necessarily really dealing with the question of what has actually occurred to create a lot. I'm assuming we have a large mental health challenge. I mean, even trauma that we're dealing with that we haven't really dealt with. How is Juneteenth being played out in the narrative of the Texas educational writing?
Well, that is a really good question, and one for which I don't know, because I have not had the opportunity to sort of really observe these classrooms to see how they're teaching it. Because you know, remember, when Juneteenth occurs, you know, kids are out of school. Mm. And so, you know, if it's taught, you know, I would have to assume that it's only given cursory attention. The students that I was sort of working with over in Accra, and they're still there now, you know, one was African American, one was Nigerian American, one was Taiwanese American, and the other was Chinese American, if I remember correctly. And what they reported to me was that they did not get a lot of exposure about Juneteenth as students. They all were products of Texas sort of K-12 educational system. And now that's just a small sort of sample, but I can't answer definitively how students are being taught, you know, at least in Texas, about mm-hmm. Juneteenth without sort of, you know, doing more in-depth sort of investigation.
Well, that's important. Yeah, you know, and I'm trying to remember because I've experienced Dr. Issa Hilliard's Zaba and the Maroons Within Us, and
mm-hmm. got that right here.
And being a member, a past member of ASCAT, you know, Association of the Study of Classical African Civilization, heard him speak many times. And he's kind of always dealt with the, as you said, the social conditioning as a part of the educational process, you know, and how we need to center our educational development from that. And here, especially online, there's some talking about independent educational process. You know, from your vantage point, education, how do you see that process should occur to address this identity issue as it relates to us being African and connecting with the continent?
It's I'm sorry, could you say the last part of your question?
In connecting, as far as the education connecting identity development, you know, for us, so that you'll be able to more healthily connect with the continent. How do you see that process rolling out, as you would?
Rolling out. So this might be a more ideological response to your question, and I don't know if it will completely answer your question, but, and again, I take my cues from Bob Asa Hillier. So one of the things that he would talk about was how, you know, what is the name that we sort of use, you know, to sort of refer to ourselves. So for example, racially, you know, we tend to sort of, you know, refer to ourselves as Black people. And it wasn't that, you know, Dr. Hillier would not sort of acknowledge that that's sort of whom we have sort of, you know, come to sort of see ourselves as, but he would ask a very simple question, where, you know, a name has to connect us to a land, it has to connect us to a culture, it has to connect us to sort of history. And so he would ask the question, where is Black land? Because, you know, if you look at other group identities, their identities will connect them generally to a body of land, a country, a culture, a history and ancestry. And they don't refer to themselves or identify themselves as a color.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, if you want to talk about sort of rolling out a process, there has to be a process where we are sort of systematically reoriented around sort of calling ourselves Black people and connecting ourselves again, I sound like a broken record, connecting ourselves to a continent, to landmass, to a culture that we can then sort of embrace and do more sort of investigation, more sort of research about where we come from and who we are, rather than simply identifying ourselves as a color. Now, the process would have to entail a re-sort of education of the teachers. Now, if you think about who's teaching our kids, you know, they're mostly white women. White women have absolutely no impetus, no motivation. There's nothing for them to be gained to sort of want to make sure that this happens to our kids. And so much of it is going to have to occur from our home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I read somewhere, and I forget, you know, again, it might have been something that Dr. Hillier, you know, would say, but that we are the only people that rely on an education system to do the primary functioning of education in terms of educating who we are. I think he would talk about Jewish people and how they have schooling that goes well beyond the sort of traditional K-12 systems, because they don't rely on schools to educate their kids about their history and who they are and what's important to them. We shouldn't either. And it's going to require a complete sort of emphasis on getting Black families, you know, African families, African American families, to understand that we have to sort of take ownership of educating our kids. We can't rely on schools to provide the type of education around identity that we know is critical for their sort of growth.
You know, I agree with what you just stated. I want to ask a question in reference to, and it might relate more to your the Urban Policy Institute, the type of question I'm gonna ask, but I'm gonna save it to after the break. And you can stay with us, Dr. Coakley, till after the break, can't you?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, good, good, good. We'll continue the discussion, and you can get involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Professor Dr. Kevin Coakley is with us. He's the director of Black Policy Institute at the University of Texas at Austin, and get involved in the conversation. Again, our guest that was supposed to be with us that was scheduled a journalist out of I don't have it in front of me, but out of Sudan, was supposed to give us an update on some of the fluid situation that was going on there. He was unable to connect with us because the internet is still down, but we'll try to arrange that interview for possibly next week. But I'll send out some notifications to that effect. Again, we'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your hosts, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1492, you came up on the shores, 700 years educated by the Moors. 17th century, genocide and the gun. Middle Passage blessed to market the Africans. in the so-called land of God. My kind were treated hard. From back then until now, I see and you agree. We have been a misrepresented people. From back then until now, just see my family tree. We have been a misrepresented people. We have been a misrepresented people.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:09 here in the city of Philadelphia. We're joined in conversation with Black Policy Institute Director, Dr. Kevin Coakley from the University of Texas at Austin. You can get involved in the conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Dr. Coakley, two things.
Yeah.
I want to spin off on your initial writing was dealing with Juneteenth, and I'm going to, and in fact, you mentioned it yourself, but I'm just going to reemphasize the fact of any of the holidays that we celebrate here, it needs to be critical discussion on, because right after Juneteenth, we had the observance of the 4th of July. If you look at social media, you find some of our people, a conscious segment that was trying to put out a different narrative of how our people felt in reference to that day. One of your colleagues down in your state, and he's been on our program before, Gerald Horn, has written about this, how our people fought against this union being the 13 colonies, the union being established, how our people fought against it because of our people being enslaved. You have a segment of our people that really don't they're maybe not aware of it, aware of the severity of it, or maybe don't care because they just want to wave a flag and eat barbecue. But it's necessary to have a discussion on these days and how it related to our people, how they felt about what was going on. And this is how I want to kind of spin this discussion. We just had a two-part segment on Time for an Awakening where we discussed the Reconstruction and how our ancestors coming out of chattel enslavement wanted to govern themselves. And it was a consensus opinion among them that they wanted to do it and they wanted to be separate because they felt that Europeans hated them. Now, if you look at some of the things that we discussed, Richard, and you're harking back to our conversations, some of the writings that's in writings that are in the Smithsonian and other places where we pulled some of the assessments from talked about how townships were started by our ancestors, and some of the Union generals just kind of sat back to observe what would happen. Our people set up deputy sheriffs of towns. They set up judges and elders. And it said that the crimes or anything going on in the towns were at a minimum. You remember those things, Richard? Some of those assessments?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we look now at our experience here, and a lot of the urban areas where we dwell is off the hook with violence, whether you're talking about Chicago, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York. These cities are off the hook with violence. It needs to be a critical discussion for our people to where this is stemming from. Because, we just had a thing here in the city of Philadelphia at a place in a gentrified area. It used to be a place where our people used to go back in the day. My parents went to hear gospel, but now it's been a gentrified area and that place has changed where white folks go there now. But some of the black politicians had a meeting there today in reference to violence being off the hook in the city of Philadelphia. And listen, whenever you have black politicians involved, all they're going to do is talk around the subject. They're not going to talk at the subject or get to the or try to get to the bottom of it. Talk about it from your perspective of a psychologist and dealing with black policy initiatives, because you talked about some of your expertise in education, income and housing, health, and mental health. The reason I'm raising this to you, Dr. Coakley, is coming out of our chattel enslavement, we were ready to take on education because our people started setting up schools immediately and they used churches to do it. The income and housing, we were providing that for one another. We were building homes and we were providing jobs because we had the expertise. Health, we always dealt with our own health back at that time. But the one area where I think it was lacking, and maybe you could help me at this, was the mental health. Because our people were coming out of a traumatic situation that they have experienced for hundreds of years, not a couple of weeks, not a couple of months. It was generational trauma. And plus, we had an added thing with that generational trauma, because out of that enslavement you had people that were traitors to their own people, what you considered Uncle Tom, what the folks would consider Uncle Toms. You had all of our people that came out of that enslavement that was still among our people. So it was mental health issues that had never been addressed. So how did that translate from a period to where our people wanted to live among themselves, to reclaim the dignity of our people, and to start working to advance our people, to violence being off the hook? What has happened in between that period as you see it, Dr. Coakley?
Well, there has been, one really, I think, good explanation. Well, there have been several explanations, but one that I'm sure you are already familiar with, and I'm sure you're familiar with the author and scholar, Dr. Joy DeGruy.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably been on your show.
Yes.
And I think that's a really good place to start, where she talks about post-traumatic slave syndrome. And,
okay.
And you know, as a psychologist, psychologists, think about sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, and think about it sort of, in a very sort of really bounded, limited sort of fashion, that there is, the experience of a traumatic event that you needed to have, been a direct recipient or of that traumatic event. And there's a whole host of sort of psychological and physical sort of consequences of exposure to that event. And, and what Dr. DeGruy has done is she's disrupted that narrative to say, well, wait a minute. It is not the case for African Americans that the only way to sort of have this experience of sort of this sort of post-traumatic sort of experience is to have directly experienced it, because, we did not directly experience the enslavement of our ancestors, but we have continued to sort of pay for it in terms of its impact. And I think part of what has happened is that in coping with continued oppression, we have unfortunately, at least in some parts of our community, adopted some unhealthy behaviors. And in adopting some of those unhealthy behaviors, we have also, engaged in what some might call self-destructive behaviors. And, Dr. Naeem Akbar, has his own sort of Afrocentric sort of mental health classification. He talks about sort of alien self disorder. He talks about these ideas where African people do harm to themselves all in service of sort of white supremacy. And so what you see in terms of the violence in these different sort of urban spaces is really just, I think, a manifestation of the impact of living in a white supremacist society. And there are responses that we could give that are very sort of rooted in research and data and statistics. You can talk about white flight. You can talk about jobs leaving these areas. You can and all that is very true, but at the core is we know that white supremacy sort of dictates that. Folks of color and African people in particular will act in ways that are self-destructive so that they can sit back, the perpetrators of white supremacy, they can just sort of sit back and just sort of not do anything, but watch us sort of destroy ourselves, because they've already put, things in place to sort of see to it that happens. Now, I also want to be sort of clear in saying that in addition to that, I also am someone who believes in agency. I believe in, not sort of ceding complete power to white supremacists.
Mm-hmm.
Believe that as a people, we have the capacity to be self-determining.
Yes.
And that we have to sort of take ownership of our own sort of circumstances. I am a strong believer in that. So I don't want you hear me say, sort of ceding complete power to white supremacy and saying that's the complete responsibility or the cause of sort of our conditions. I think you use the term sort of like the puppet, the puppeteer, the puppets, it certainly is the overarching thing, but as a people, we have to sort of take some responsibility for our own circumstances and conditions as well, even in the midst of understanding that we operate within a system of global white supremacy.
And okay. isn't following up on that specifically, and it's another sort of just a side thing, but isn't that what Dr. Wade Noble brings up with the whole notion of Sekou, as far as the spiritual component to African people in relationship to that agency? Does that fit his model fit to that point of not only that we have a conscious responsibility, we have an unconscious spiritual response action in our own.
Absolutely. Dr. Nobles, when he, you know, sort of introduces this powerful idea of Saiku, and he talks about the Saiku Chetty, you know, he says that psychologists, at least for Black African-centered psychologists, we are really Saiku Chetty. You know, our job is really to sort of illuminate, you know, the spirit, you know, sort of moving, you know, and illuminating and understanding sort of the spirit and spiritual concerns, then it helps us better understand the manifestations or what we see in terms of sort of behaviors, because at the root of these behaviors is some sort of spiritual disruption. And we need to understand that to understand its sort of physical, material sort of manifestation in terms of the violence that we see in our neighborhoods. So, yeah, thank you for, yeah.
And that goes to what, I mean, now, especially with the, it seems to be, or at least from my vantage point of, you know, just cursory understanding in relationship to epigenetics. How Elliot framed it, you know, that you don't necessarily have to be, have the impact. Be the primary impact of the experience for the experience to be still affecting you from one generation to the other because of the how epigenetics operate, in the sense that it can move from one generation, the impact can move from one generation to the other. That psychological disruption or spiritual disruption then manifests itself, even though we're a few generations, just a few, removed. I have to ask it this way. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm certainly no expert on epigenetics, but from the very little that I think I understand about it, you know, sort of talks about sort of like, you know, being able to sort of inherit trauma. And when we apply that to people of African descent, sort of understanding that we have, you know, inherited the trauma of our ancestors that has been passed down from generation to generation. And that's a, if you think about it, that's a really deep and profound concept that we can literally have trauma passed from generation to generation through this idea of sort of epigenetics. Again, I'm no expert on it, but the little that I've read, and I think I understand that something that really resonates with me.
And something that, you know, in tying into your article, something that relates to when we put these events together. And Elliot, you mentioned about, you know, having, you know, just the critical, you know, the critical for some reason, critical thinking component as a part of the event becomes important. So when we're talking about Juneteenth, which is truly dealing with those as a part of the ancestors that have experienced that, we should have events that relate that, you know, relate that trauma and, you know, be able to help us as an event to at least be aware of it. And the effects of it and how we're seeing it manifest in our communities, especially as it relates to violence, it seems to me, and as it relates to our relationship to those on the continent. Again, you know, yeah. It just seems to, because a court which said that y'all were there dealing with the whole question about bleaching cream. And I noticed that bleaching cream was being outlawed in various countries, and Ghana being one of them. But as you said, obviously there's an underground market.
Yes.
That Africans on the continent has experienced in relationship to self-identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
That's deep.
I know it.
Go ahead. It is deep. If I could just go back to something that you mentioned briefly, but you didn't have a chance, you didn't really elaborate on. You know, you talked about sort of the holiday, you know, sort of following Juneteenth. Being the 4th of July and Black people's sort of relationship to that. And, you know, you see during the 4th of July, you know, if you're on social media, you know, you'll see, you know, some Black folks, at least, you know, some conscious Black folks who will, you know, share the article, you know, or the speech by Frederick Douglass, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" And so, I mean, that always sort of, it's cyclical. Every time the 4th of July comes up, you know there are going to be some conscious Black people who make sure to share that article, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" But, you know, something else happened this year that you might be aware of, and that is you had a group of Black pastors who recently sort of decided to using the term sort of blackout their support of Colin Kaepernick. So they became really critical because you know Colin Kaepernick you know caused Nike to sort of change their minds about their new sort of flag embrace, you know, flag decorated shoe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so Colin Kaepernick, you know, came out, you know, I mean, he said whatever it is and he said, you know, to those folks. And so, you know, they ended up sort of, you know, killing that idea. And I was really surprised, you know, when it crossed my social media sort of feed, you know, I see this article about Black pastors who decided that they've had enough with Colin Kaepernick and basically, you know, do not want to sort of give him any sort of support because they disagree with him on this particular issue. And you raised the point earlier about sort of what role does religion play.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a perfect example of how, unfortunately, religion can be a detriment.
Yes.
And I say that as, you know, as someone who was raised in the church, you know, I do identify myself as a Christian, problems and, you know, the problematics of Christianity notwithstanding. But this is why, one of the reasons why you have a lot of conscious folks who slam Christianity, because to have these Black pastors actually decide that they were going to speak out against Kaepernick in such a public manner is deeply, deeply problematic. And to then go on to sort of talk about, you know, sort of almost sort of defending Black people, you know, sort of celebration of 4th of July. Look, you know, if you want to go and have your cookouts and have family gatherings and whatever, you know, and use the 4th of July to do that, do you? I mean, I'm not going to criticize that, but let's not pretend that the 4th of July is a meaningful symbolic holiday for African Americans. It is not. And that's the part that's so deeply disturbing. And you want to talk about sort of needing to sort of reorient and re-educate our people. That's a perfect example of where that sort of education needs to take place.
And it gets to one of the fundamental things in my mind. And I guess I'm pushing something, because it seems that the African experience under particular oppression, there's been always the moral imperative that we have to have to enunciate. And it seems, you know, and you can't support the dehumanization of people, the destruction of a people, and have a moral imperative. I don't care what faith-based system you belong to. And we have experienced it specifically. I mean, we have an experiential. We had to overcome being from property to even, being identified, at least a citizen. I'm not sure whether we have accomplished the, you know, that we are part of the human family within this American context, within the celebration of what the American independence was supposed to be, because the American independence was supposed to be about degrading a part of the human family so it can be able to benefit from it. So it seems that African people have this moral imperative, and to not acknowledge it seems to be a challenge, you know, and to have the institution of religion, which is supposed to be fundamentally about perpetuating the moral imperative as one of its vocations, not being able to recognize what social justice or what individuals' stance are, especially Black people, it doesn't make sense. It does, to what y'all had said earlier, it is not only counterintuitive, it's working against. It's self-destructive.
Hmm. Yes.
Yes, it is.
You know?
Let's go to 602. 602?
Yes. Good evening, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, and Dr. Coakley.
How are you, sir?
Brother Marcus. I'm doing great.
Good evening, brother.
You know, what the doctor says, he says right, you know, you're correct. You know, because I can tell you, for one, coming from the Caribbean, born in Jamaica, when I was coming to America in 1980 as a teenager, we had a black counselor, U.S. counselor, and he told us, he said, look, he said, America is a beautiful country, but you see those black people over there, don't associate with them because they're lazy. No, this is a black man, you know, at the U.S. embassy telling us this. Now, if it was a white man, you know, the alarm bells would have went off automatically, but I guess being it's black, you know, it doesn't register that, you know. And I see my parents come here, and they kept that mentality. But me being as a young man, you know, running around with the girls, ignore what the hell you say. So, you know, it's, you know, and you talk about religion.
Let me say, before you go to that, Brother Marcus, when that was stated, because I assume it was stated among a group of people, did anybody question, what do you mean by that? Or did they question?
No, nobody questioned it. Because you want to come to America. You don't want to say anything that's going to tarnish your, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
You just want to go in there and get food and come out. You know what I'm saying? Because you're coming to America. This is where everything is. The greatest country in the world. I was in a culture shock when I came to America. The first night I came here, I was shocked. I said, this is America? He said, yes, this is America. You in America. You know, so, I mean, they were people speaking Spanish. I said, I didn't know they speak Spanish in America, you know. But nobody questioned it because, you know what I'm saying, you just want to get in there, get your visa, and come to America. And you're going to come and pick up gold in the street. You know, you come, you find it's a rude awakening. So, religion. Now, the same situation we see here happening with this Europeanized African, it's the same thing in Africa too, with the Arabized African. See? It's the Arabized African that's causing the problem, even in Sudan as we speak. It's black people, but they are Arabized, their minds are Arabs. They have more affinity with Arabia than Africa. So the same damage that was done to black people, you know, with Europeanism, is the same thing that's going on the continent with the Arabs too, and black people. So we have a lot of work, you know, to correct the damage that's been done to the minds of our people, because that's where the revolution got to go. No one asks the Dr. Coakley a question, and it's about love. Because we hear our people said, oh, well, if we could just love each other, if black people could just love each other. Well, then I asked myself, I said, but who is teaching us love? Who is teaching us about love? Is it the same people here that been victimizing us, that's teaching us about love? If they are teaching us about love, then the dog can, you know, eat our supper, because these people know nothing about love. So if brother could just expound a little bit about that for me and black love and what does that really mean for us? Because that's what we need. You say we need our minds, and we need, how do we learn to love each other as black folks? And I'll hang up and listen to your response, good brother. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Man, that's a deep question, brother. I mean, you know, black love. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. Like we can't look to, you know, our oppressors to understand anything about love, and certainly not black love. Look, you know, when we have to understand that as black people, as African people, we have been systematically sort of taught to not love ourselves, not to love our people. I mean, it has been a very intentional sort of process. And so simply, you know, simply just saying, you know, we need to love, unfortunately is not going to be enough. I mean, it's, you know, it's a start, but what does that mean? I mean, you know, and what does it look like in action? You know, for example, you know, to me, part of sort of like, you know, Black love encompasses Black, you know, respect. It encompasses sort of trust. You know, when I think about some of the things, some of the statements that I've heard Black people make about, you know, going and sort of, you know, utilizing Black businesses, just for an example, and some of the things that they, you know, some Black folks will say about, you know, I'm not going to a Black, you know, I'm not going to go to a Black bank, or I'm not going to, you know, shop at a Black owned business, or I'm not going to do this, you know, because they sort of bought into this idea that Black people are incompetent, that they are not good business people, that they are not people to whom they should sort of give their business, give their money to. I conceptualize that as a part of this sort of like, you know, Black love sort of conversation, because you can't love, we can't love each other if we don't trust each other, if we don't support each other. You know, Black love is one of those things that that's almost sort of like a, if I think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's a higher order sort of goal. Before we can even get there, we've got to like each other, we've got to respect each other, we've got to support each other, we've got to sort of patron each other, you know, we've got to sort of go to each other's, you know, businesses, we, you know, we've got to do those sort of very basic things before we can just sort of, you know, get to this, what I would call this higher order sort of like Black love. That's just my opinion.
Let me take Richard. You want to say something?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, I would. Well, first, it's been dying. Dr. Coakley. Now, I'm a advocate of Steve Coakley. So, when I seen your name, I said, "Wait a minute, is there any relationship here?"
No. His name is Coakley. Mine is Coakley.
Oh, okay.
I guess that's quite a bit.
Okay. I was like, "Okay, wait a minute now." Okay. But you know, it was something else that came up in our conversation, and I think it's important because this from what I understand that Dr. Nobles and Naeem Akbar and Baba Issa Hilliard and bringing it to and Dr. Cambone, y'all have really created a psychological model that specifically deals with Black people, mental model that you're working out. When we're talking about an African-centered perspective, first I need to make sure I got clarity on that. That this is a unique model that the psychologists have been working over a couple of generations now that has a scientific basis. Would that be a correct statement?
Yes and no. So yes, it is true that Black psychologists and African-centered psychologists in particular have worked on sort of defining for us what it means to be mentally healthy from an African-centered sort of point of view. That part is true. Now, when you start talking about sort of is it rooted in like a scientific basis, I mean, I guess okay. It probably depends on what your definition of science is. You know, certainly not science as maybe understood through a sort of a Western empiricist lens. Mm-hmm. But if you talk about, you know, maybe sort of like a metaphysical sort of thing, that would be a different understanding.
Mm. And I do need to get that clarity because I'm kind of trying to encapsulate, as you say, our agency. Because we're actually engaged.
Say that again, Richard. You broke up.
We're engaged in a project that don't exist. So we do need to have a unique model of understanding of our own psychological, you know,
what is healthy? What is meant? What is it to be mentally healthy? And one of those components is what is Black love, as Brother Marcus brought up, you know, so that we are clear about that. And that's, I just wanted to, you know, as I go through this to understand that, because I, hopefully it will become a science so that we can evaluate on our own terms whether we are healthy or not, or those who are actually taking on something else.
You mentioned, you know, Dr. Cambone, who we know, you know, recently sort of transitioned,
right,
a giant in our field, and Baba Kobe, Dr. Cambone, you know, talked about this concept that he called cultural misorientation, mm-hmm. And he talked about it within the context of mental health, and he sort of defined this sort of cultural misorientation as this, what he called a psychopathological condition amongst Black people, where we have an incorrect cultural orientation towards sort of those things that are more Eurocentric. And so he gave, you know, and I always teach about this in my class. He would give very specific examples of what he believed to be cultural misorientation that he believed to be indicators of things that are sort of negatively connected to our mental health. So for example, and this is, you know, and yeah, I don't, this is going to take us into a whole other place, and I, you know, that's for another, you know, conversation, but he gave us an example, you know, having an obsession with, you know, sort of straightening your hair, curling your hair to approximate sort of a Caucasian, you know, sort of texture, you know, this idea of so-called good hair. Very, that's like Black psychology 101, like that is so sort of problematic. But for Black psychologists, we've had to sort of say, look, you know, from a Eurocentric psychological perspective, there's really nothing wrong with that. It would not be seen as something that would rise to a level of concern. But for Black folk, and for a Black psychologist, it absolutely is an indicator of some sort of mental health concern, that if you are try to take your appearance and to try to make it more approximate to that of a white person, then that is something that is a mental health concern that we should attend to. And so for Black psychologists, we have, and what the Association of Black Psychologists has done for many years, 50 plus years, is to say, look, we can no longer rely on the definition of mental health from Europeans to be sort of relevant to our own mental health. We know what is mental health, what constitutes mental health for our people. And we know those things, those behaviors, those attitudes that go against, you know, sort of optimal mental health for our people. And that's really the value of Black psychology, of the Association of Black Psychologists, of people like Wade Nobles and Kobe Cambone and Nathan Harriet and Naeem Magbar and those, and Linda James Myers and those sort of people, because they helped us to sort of rethink what mental health means and what mental healthy behavior looks like amongst Black people.
And that ties to, again, going to, you know, to your article for me, and I'm just reemphasizing the point, because when we put together celebrations or, you know, events, and I'm calling them events at this point, say like Juneteenth, and this is something that's growing all across the country, if we don't add those components, Elliot, you have mentioned, you know, we need to have that understanding when we put together these events, so that they be the cultural events, and it seemed to be what Baba Asa Hilliard was talking about, that the psychology is also tied to our sociology. And so mm-hmm. our social events have to reflect or have to assist in either reinforcing our identity or in the healing process as a part of our educational outcome to our identity in order for us to actually be a whole people. And so it seems that, you know, and that was why your article seemed important to me, because if we did that, then it would naturally connect us to the continent because mm-hmm. of
yep.
the activity itself as an event, as a cultural event, and as a recognition of dealing with our tying to landmass and a people and a historical context outside of our enslavement.
Yes.
Let's try to squeeze another one in here. Let's go to 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Brother Richard, and to your distinguished guest. Hi, Dr. Coakley. How you doing, my brother?
I'm doing fine, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Our praises be to Allah. Dr. Coakley, let me, before I talk about the mental health stuff that our people are dealing with, you know, when you talk about those black preachers that came out against Brother Colin Kaepernick, no surprise there, because, you know, remember the group of Negroes that came out for Donald Trump, a group of black handkerchief head preachers came out for Donald Trump and for Jeff Sessions. So, I mean, that don't surprise me. Somehow I'm not shocked about that. You know what I mean? But anyway, Brother Coakley, you know, there's so many things facing our people. You're talking about mental health. For example, Dr. Coakley and Brother Ellen and Brother Richard, when you look at the situation with the opioids, you see white folks all of a sudden, they show a concern for white folks that have got hooked on drugs. But when the crack epidemic, you know, was coming through Philadelphia, L.A., and by the way, a lot of it was done through the CIA with Ronald Reagan and Oliver North and the Iran-Contra stuff, so, I mean, all that kind of stuff. They didn't care. It was coming up with punishment. So the treatment for our people was punishment. You know, crack was ruining black communities and Latino communities across America, but some of those white folks got hit with it. Then all of a sudden, these same white lawmakers, they've got sympathy. And I said the mental health part of Brother Coakley, because I don't think enough attention is paid to the mental health thing, because when you look at some of our children in the black community, the ones that's out here doing killing and all this crazy stuff that they're doing, don't forget, Dr. Coakley, a lot of them are crack addicted babies, because I know cases right here in Philadelphia, right up here in the Germantown section where I live at. I know brothers that are on crack, and I know some of the sisters they have procreated with on crack. So these people have sex and stuff, and they create babies. So don't take a rocket scientist, Dr. Coakley, to see that baby come right in the world with crack on his system, because the crack is inside the sperm. So when they procreate, that baby coming into this world already with crack in their system. So that's why a lot of these children you see out here today with the self-hatred, the tendency to be violent, they messed up from the start. If they don't get some kind of help or physical or mental kind of help, they do them from the start, because they're coming in this world already messed up. And that's why you see a lot of this stuff happen in communities, because you're dealing with crack-addicted babies and stuff, where white America helped cause that. Now, I agree with you, too, Dr. Coakley, that in the midst of white supremacy doing all the destructive things it's doing, we also have to, like you say, take some responsibility and try to clean this up. Because we already know what we're up against, so we definitely got to try to get our communities in order some kind of way. And again, I don't claim to have all the answers, but I listen to shows like Time for the Awakening so I can get ideas from people like yourself, Dr. Coakley, Brother Elliot, and Brother Richard, because I'd be I'm a member of the Nation of Islam under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Minister Louis Farrakhan, but I don't never claim that I got all the answers. I'm willing to work with anybody, Dr. Coakley, whether it be Christian, Muslim, atheist, Jewish, whatever, that can help our people get it together. Because again, it's not going to take one entity to do it. It's going to take many ideas and many people, groups coming together and stuff to try to solve this thing. We face a myriad of problems. We see we got police officers, racist cops against our people. We got black politicians, black ministers against our people. So we face them, and we got traitors within the black community. So we got all kinds of things we're dealing with. So I'm willing to sit back and listen to what you got to say, Dr. Coakley, work some ideas you can come up with to deal with this thing. Because again, I don't think enough focus is on the mental health, because I see the mentality of some of our young brothers and sisters in the community, and their mindset is messed up, Dr. Coakley. I mean, I see this on an everyday basis, the language coming out of their mouth, their mindset. I mean, it's real. I mean, it's nothing that somebody told me through the grapevine. I witness this on a regular basis. I mean, their mindsets are messed up, man. So, I mean, this is something that we got to definitely deal with, the mental health aspect of why, for example, I close with this, Dr. Coakley, like right here in Philadelphia yesterday, you had a playground, children was playing in the playground, you had a cookout, whatever it was, and you had a similar event back here around a month ago at one of the playgrounds out in Southwest Philadelphia. And even a simple cookout with kids playing in the playground or having a cookout for a graduation, it resorts to violence. But some ignorant brother come out shooting and stuff with kids fighting, got the duck for cover adults. So, I mean, this is how we deal with this stuff in Philadelphia, like we dealing with in Baltimore and other places. So we see clearly that the mental health aspect definitely got to be dealt with, Dr. Coakley. I just want to sit back and listen to your comments and Brother Ellie and Richard and just, you know, listen to the rest of the show. Thank you, Dr. Coakley.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Dr. Coakley, go ahead.
So mental health is one of those issues where as a community, we're still not comfortable talking about it. We're still not comfortable acknowledging that there are some deep-seated mental health issues, you know, in our communities. You know, I've given, you know, a number of talks about, you know, Black people and mental health, and I will show a slide, and on that slide, I'll have two pictures. On one picture, there's, you know, a sort of a picture of a Black person, you know, getting some sort of like therapy, and in another picture is a picture of like a religious environment, you know, typically like a church. And I'll ask, you know, students, you know, Black students, if you were in mental distress and needing, you know, some sort of help, which one of these pictures would be most appealing to you in terms of a source of getting help? And the brother said it doesn't take rocket science, and he's absolutely right, because it doesn't take rocket science for you to be able to predict what most Black people will point to in terms of mm-hmm. where they would want to go if they were in sort of mental health, you know, mental distress.
Yep.
And they're not pointing to the picture of a traditional sort of mental health sort of environment. They're pointing to that picture that looks like the church, you know, and I'll tell people, look, you know, there was, you know, a few years ago, there was a saying, too blessed to be stressed. And that was an attempt, I think, by some religious folks to say, look, you know, if you're in distress, you know, all you need to do is sort of pray, and you need to go to God in prayer, and you can sort of pray it away. And this is not to disparage the power and the importance of prayer, but you can't just pray away mental health issues. That's not how that works. And as a community, we have not really fully understood the tremendous challenges that we have regarding mental health, and that what we need to do is to take advantage of those sort of mental health services, preferably offered by Black people, Black therapists, although certain there are other therapists, you know, if they have the proper orientation, could be helpful. But I'm a strong believer in taking advantage of Black mental health support services to help us deal with our mental health challenges. And, you know, I think about the way that I sort of grew up, and every Black family can point to that uncle, that auntie, that person in the family who everyone knew was, you know, just a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But people wouldn't talk about that person openly or publicly. You know, it's always sort of like whispers or closed door conversations, or there's a certain amount of shame. But we can't be ashamed of our family members who have mental health challenges. And that remains a very difficult issue for us to sort of talk about openly.
And it's definitely a policy position that we have to address, because it's not a lot of men and women like yourselves who are in the profession, one, and then two, that is have that African-centered perspective, and as it relates to the mental understanding, mental mindset, mental model of African Americans, there, and then at the level of which we can afford to partake in the services, and so it requires us to, you know, look at this, you know, very seriously and very deeply in relationship to even our political will to support the funding to support mental health.
Well, and brother, you're absolutely right. And the other part to that is, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard Black people say that, you know, Black people don't go to therapy. That's some white people stuff. Like, you know, we don't talk to strangers about our problems. You know, white people do that. And we've got to get beyond that, because that's holding us back. You know, we absolutely need to seek help that's culturally appropriate, you know, to help us sort of, you know, deal with whatever mental health challenges that we have.
Yes, that's true. I agree. And that is powerful, important, culturally appropriate.
Dr. Coakley, listen, I want to thank you for sharing with us. It was an interesting article, and I know that you'll be writing some more. The door is always open. You come back and talk about anything you want, any things that you feel it's important for the community to know about on the Black Policy Institute Initiative or even on the psychologist front. The door is always open to you.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Thank you. Peace.
All right. Peace. Asante sana.
All right.
Sunday.
Richard.
Yes, sir.
Interesting conversation. boy, I was just thinking about some of the things that not only that Brother Joe mentioned, but Brother Marcus, when they came here, where they were told that, I mean, you know, you always hear that as a rumor. You never mm-hmm. think that somebody got the heart enough to say something like that. Mm-hmm. But wow,
what's so powerful and important that people understand about this is an orientation by a policy, you know, that is carried out for anybody who has that job. Now we have to raise the question: is that a collaborator? Is that, you know, I mean, like they may not be willingly doing it, but they're doing their job. And how many people are doing their job, you know, to maintain whatever it is that they think is important for them, that is in essence harming us, not as just a people here in North America, but this is, you know, to Africans from the Caribbean, from the continent. We hear it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And these people who are doing it, a Black person, if you really, you know, as everybody's saying, if you really got deep with it, they'll just in the end tell you they're just doing their job. And how many of us are doing our job that is hurting us because we're doing our job?
That's
serious.
It is. It is, and these things got to be, we got to talk about these things. They got to be up for critical discussion, and we got to not be afraid to talk about these things. You know, and not only talk about them, come up with plans to counteract and defend ourselves against these are attacks, Richard. They are attacks, right. Systematic attacks.
Against inherent in the system.
Yes.
Inherent in the system.
Yeah, definitely against Black life in this country, you know. And I mentioned it to the doctor when he was on. You know, they had that big I don't want to say conference. They had the big thing here at the Met today, dealing with violence. I think Street Son, Therese Street, and some other politicians was going to be there. And you know, they're going to talk around these that you put the guns down, and that's not, come on, that's a cliche.
Mm-hmm. And you know what, Elliot, as I seen him went over the week, because I had to question whether I was going to attend or not, and I'm now, I can say I done been through two generational cycles, right, of seeing the same type of forums.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I remember when Dave Richardson and them had the same type of forum. I remember when Bilal Qayyum and them did the first initiative around that. And that was to address that generation. The generation at that point I was a member of. Then the second generation. You know what I mean? When Brother Joe talks about the crack epidemic. Well, that was another generation. And it's speaking to generation, but not necessarily that we need a cultural change and need to deal with the question, if you got one out of every four person living below the poverty, saying, as Brother Joe brought up, not just having children that are, both parents have chemical dependency, but when both parents can't even provide a livelihood for the child they bring into being. And that's systemic. I mean, how is that being addressed? You can't address the outcome of violence and not address that there is no life livelihood for the children. Those are young people.
Yes.
Who need to have activities to be directed, or at least to help them assist in dealing with the discipline to hear for the violence that they may exhibit. I mean, it's you know, and at this stage, it just, you know, what is that? As you say, it becomes, you know, some superficial, well, you know, we're going to pay you for your guns.
That ain't it. And then they'll go right, you know, this community is violent. I mean, this nation is violent. It was brought about by violence and the gun. So taking away a gun from somebody or having them turn it in for a $50 coupon to a supermarket, if they want it, they can go back and get another one the next day. They're readily available. I mean, you can't, come on. This conversation.
So, and
go ahead.
And it deals with the psychology. It deals with the psychology, you know, and primarily the psychology of fear. Because if all of us are, I mean, and I'm always using the emphasis, that Dr. Amos Wilson said, if all of us good people are afraid to deal with the critical questions that affect our lives, i.e. how we relate to one another, because you get the example out of Reconstruction, you didn't have that level of violence.
I know it.
In the towns that they created, because there was a critical relationship between the people and a vision of what they were trying to accomplish. That all the generations were involved, and you've seen within a short period of time the manifestation of that.
And plus, wait a minute, and another factor too, Richard, is we controlled the community. We controlled the commerce of the community. We created the jobs. See, you know, we're not in control of our community. You got black elected officials, but they don't control it and don't put in programs to help the black community control their community. They put in programs to help other people, Latinos, Asians, Jewish folk. Everybody comes and control the economy of our community and get assistance from black politicians. You can't stop this type of stuff, and you don't have no economy. You can't offer jobs to these young people. And you don't have no outlets for them. I was talking the other day to a guy, Richard. Listen, and it's not that long ago. When I was young in South Philadelphia, you had, you know, because I was a ball player. You know, you play in high school, and then they had the leagues around. I mean, tough leagues all through South Philly. They had one at Pierce. They had one at Landriff. They had one at Benson. They had one at Arthur. Barrett. All of the places had leagues. And if you was playing ball, I mean, where I was from, you had that Carpenter Street gang. But I didn't have no problem going down to Pierce and playing. Or I didn't have no problem going to Benson or Landriff. Because when you were playing, you had carte blanche to go to these other places. It was no problems. But you had activities where you could play in all these yards. And people used to come out and watch the games. And I'm not saying there was no utopia, because you might have had some fights and all after the game.
Right.
But it was still activities. Now, if you go in those same communities, Richard, all those places that I mentioned to you don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
They paved over those yards, but the children are still in those communities that ain't been pushed out by gentrification. It's no more Arthur Schoolyard. It's no more Pierce Schoolyard. It's no more Barrett Schoolyard. Benson and Landriff don't exist anymore. All those places. You still got children in these areas. So where are they playing at? Where are they going? You got libraries in the community that's been shut down. I remember under that previous mayor, that idiot Nutter.
He shut the
libraries down in your communities. If you don't have no rec centers for the children to go, and you shut the libraries down, what the hell you expect? And then they want to run around. I'm a black politician. Vote for me. You ain't, man, I'm telling you. If you could necklace, that's where I agree with the brother Jay out of New York about necklacing, putting a necklace on some of these people. They're a disgrace, Richard. And it's not like they don't know what's going on. They're intelligent men and women. They ain't stupid.
they doing intentionally what they want to do. And a lot of times it's for a little monetary gain, little shekels here and there. You could see it when they get their hand smacked or when they get caught and the man throw them behind bars, they done took $500, $200, $1,000, a Tiffany bracelet, all kind of old stupid stuff. I see where Shaka Fatah tried to get his sentence commuted.
They ain't touched.
They said, you got 10 years then, you still got 10 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we got to have some serious discussion. And it's more and more is coming, Richard. I see that Brother Khalid is going to be here in August. I think he's be speaking at 52nd. I think it's on 52nd Street. Somebody's bringing him in here. I got to call him and see.
Who's that?
Khalid Raheem of the Universal African People's Party. Mm-hmm. I see somebody else is bringing him here, which is good. Great. Maybe they heard about it. In fact, I know they heard about it either from the program or from that function that we had him over there with. So I got to get in contact with whoever it is because now things are starting to grow. It's starting to move. Utilize these parties. If we're going to be, not if we're going to be, we're involved in politics, we got to have African-centered politics and African-centered politicians. You got to develop them. We don't have them now. These people in African-centered, they'll use African people for political gain. Like you see the Kamala Harris's and the Cory Booker's using the issue of reparations as a political gain. They want to call out Biden and all, say he's a racist. He consorted with racists. He was friends with racists. Okay, that's wow. What a revelation. This has been, everybody knows that. But now it's politically expedient for them to say all that type of stuff. And then if they lose or don't get the political position that they want, they'll go right back to doing what they was doing before. Being a mouthpiece for somebody else. Like Cory Booker was a mouthpiece for AIPAC. AIPAC is the one that pushed him and got him to that seat he's at. Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the struggle continues, Richard. That's all I got to say.
and we're struggling at 110%, you know, and it's all good.
Before we leave, I want to get the lineups again, African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. At 1 to 3, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. That's 1 to 3 on Mondays and Wednesdays on Time for an Awakening Media. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. The popularity of Dr. Rogers' show is growing, Richard. I mean, boy, I'm telling you, the people can't wait till the podcast go up. They jumping at it. I mean, they love Oshi and Dr. Rogers' program.
It's great.
Oh, I forgot. How did I forget? 6 to 8 on Time for Awakening Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And this Monday, because it was, it's every other Monday, Conversation Reparations within Cobra is from 9 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. And we're going to have a special surprise. I know I keep saying it. People are probably ready to run me off the air. But we're going to have it ready this week. I done had some computer issues. I had to pick up a new computer. Things going on. But we'll be ready this week. Listen, Gordies, I'll just say that. I'm not going to put myself out there. But I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do.
Oh, okay. I was getting ready to say, I heard you say earlier about them papers. Don't be treating the papers like I do them books on my floor all over the place. Can't find the names or whatever.
Oh, boy. Listen, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers on Tuesday from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. Wednesday, Revive, which is the POC, 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening on Thursdays. It's a little hiatus right now with Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8. They'll be back soon. Little hiatus for their show. But it's another show starting up. One of Dr. Rogers' understudies, they'll be starting up soon. A couple of young ladies, I'll get the little details on their program, probably get them on and showcase them. Yeah, they'll be coming up soon. And on Fridays, Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. To play such a small part of the things that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman. Hey, hey, hey.